Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net.
Hannah, I chose beer this evening because I think it has a perfect tie-in with one of the films we'll be talking about tonight.
It looks like it's called Tiki Leaks.
It's from Flying Dog Brewery, which is just
which
up the
is
road.
Nearby.
It's up there in Frederick, Maryland. It is Tiki Leaks. It's a Mai Tai blonde.
See, here I thought you would find something that had to do with Once Upon a Time, but I'm guessing that that has more to do with the documentary we'll discuss called The Great Hack, perhaps?
It does. Tiki Leaks, actually WikiLeaks briefly, comes up in that film. And I just saw that and I was like, you know what, that's kind of a perfect match.
Sure.
I'd never heard of a Mai Tai blonde. So when you're sipping this, if you can taste pineapple, tangerine, lime juice, and hibiscus flowers.
It's quite an interesting color and consistency. It feels a little almost heavier, I guess, than...
It should feel heavy because it's 7.8%.
Okay. Well, cheers then.
We're batting leadoff tonight with a rarity. We rarely get Tarantino films. The posters all say, the ninth film by Quentin Tarantino. And for as long as he's been making pictures, that's actually not that many. You know, it's a couple a decade.
And he insists that this is his second to last, that he's only got one more in him.
It's possible.
Mm-hmm.
Because
that's what he says.
For many people, especially for me, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood felt like Tarantino's Roma. It's a love letter to something he cherishes. And apparently he cherishes old school Los Angeles, specifically 1969 Los Angeles. And if you're familiar with Quentin Tarantino, then you're familiar with the idea of multiple parallel plot lines. He made it famous, really made his, it wasn't his first movie, but he made it, really made his mark in Pulp Fiction, which did that, multiple plot lines. And he returns to that. Two main ones. One is Leonardo DiCaprio, who does a superb job as fading actor Rick Dalton.
Mm-hmm.
Rick Dalton gave up Bounty Law, which is a great start to the film. It's all about it looks like Gunsmoke, I suppose.
A little bit of Gunsmoke, a little bit of Maverick, and so if you were from a little bit of The Rifleman.
A little too early for me.
Yeah.
A little too early.
But those are the kind of the throwbacks. Oh, even a little feel like a little bit of like the Lone Ranger. That look.
Yeah, it's black and white and it's tongue in cheek and it's a weekly serial western. He tried his hands at films, made a couple, didn't take, and now he's fading. Now he plays what they call the heavy. He's the bad guy on new pilots, you know, for the up-and-coming stars and their new shows. If they defeat Rick Dalton, then it's like, oh, you're somebody. You defeated Rick Dalton. So there he is at lunch with Al Pacino, who's playing this agent, the super agent, saying,
Schwartz.
And he's giving him the truth. He's giving him the truth bomb. You're finished in Hollywood. You're going downhill, so you need to make Italian spaghetti westerns. So Rick, he's a very sensitive guy. He's out there in the parking lot and he's crying. And there's the other plot line. Calvin Booth, stunt man, Rick Dalton, stunt double, Cliff Booth.
I think it's Cliff.
You're absolutely right. I'm not looking at my notes. Played by Brad Pitt. He's Rick Dalton's everything. Yes, he's his chauffeur. He's his handyman. You know, fix my house while I'm at work. He's his psychiatrist, he's his confidant, and he's his friend. He's on the payroll, but they are friends, and they're dynamic. DiCaprio and Pitt.
But he was a stunt double for years.
For
Bounty Law.
For Bounty Law. After that, Cliff.
That's Cliff faded. The need
Cliff faded. Something happened to Cliff.
Yeah.
We're not going to go into something, but Rick Dalton is Cliff's only friend, I believe.
His dog.
There's great scenes with the dog. And what I'm saying is, yes, there's plot. Unlike the lady next to me who screamed out at the end of the film, what was the plot?
There was no plot.
There was...
I didn't scream it. Wasn't me next to you, but I know plenty of people who said
there's
that.
There's lots of plot, but it's not about plot. It's about Los Angeles. It's about a very specific time, 1969 Los Angeles, because Rick Dalton happens, coincidentally, to live next door to Roman Polanski and Sharon Tate. Very famous names in a very famous place in a very famous year where something happens to Sharon Tate. Sharon Tate has her own plot line, and she doesn't really interact with anybody else in the film. She's off by herself until she circles back later at key points. She's played by Margot Robbie. Now, you know, Hannah, when I say there's a couple of perfect scenes a year. I brought that up when we saw Rocket Man, and I brought up Taron Egerton and the Crocodile Rock scene. This is not a perfect scene, but it's one of those... There's a magical moment in this movie, folks. Margot Robbie, as Sharon Tate, goes to the movie theater. She's in a movie called The Wrecking Crew, and she's starring opposite Dean Martin, and she goes in, and she's anonymous. She's not telling anybody she's there. She's looking around. She's laughing with the crowd. She's looking to see that they laugh at the appropriate times, and she's marveling at herself, and she's having such a good time. And that right there, Hannah, was a magical movie moment for me.
But it's one very small moment in this film. And so the fact that there is no plot, even just you trying to kind of explain
how
these
can
characters.
You say there is no plot?
No, but it's intentional with what he's doing. It's like, I think he's looking at it as going, it is about these two guys going about their daily lives with the backdrop of what happened to Sharon Tate and with the Manson family. In the summer of 69.
That sounds like a lot of Manson family screams
but
plot.
Because they're not part of the reality of the plot at
sure
all.
Brad Pitt has been making eyes at this hippie all movie, like three times. He's just making eyes. Finally, she gets in his Cadillac and she drives him out to the Manson family ranch, and he really gets a good look at everything. That's plot.
I don't think there was. I think that is the intersection. There's multiple threads going on here, but I think what could be very confusing to a lot of people, and where the idea that there is no linear plot certainly is that is that you've got a weird, but you have this hybrid of fictional characters. So your two big guys are fictional.
Yeah, that's true. There are two fictional characters operating in a real universe.
So Rick Dalton and Cliff Booth, Leo DiCaprio and Brad Pitt, who are amazing in this film. I thought they were great.
Especially Leo.
Leo is amazing to watch. But you've got, they're interacting with these real people.
But that's not
the
confusing.
The people who really existed.
You can
sure
see,
it is. Depending
what, Forrest
on what
Gump
your,
was fictional? Did that confuse you?
Depending on what your frame of reference is for some of these people.
Did you not?
You
did,
don't
was
know,
Forrest Gump actually talking to
but
JFK?
You don't know necessarily, just if you are just kind of walking into this film kind of blind, you don't know what's supposed to be a real character doing, like, that's seeped in reality versus what is purely fictional.
Why are you so focused on plot?
I like plot. When I see a movie, I like plot.
You're in 69 Los Angeles, and you're at the Playboy Mansion, and you didn't get a little shiver watching Michelle Phillips and Mama Cass dance with Sharon Tate, and there's Steve McQueen watching them?
No, I mean, that's just it. There's a lot for me to really like about this film. For me, this is the only Quentin Tarantino movie that I actually like.
Wait.
I did not like Pulp Fiction. I did not like Kill Bill. I did not like Reservoir Dogs. These are not my kind of movies.
What's wrong with you?
Well, I'm just not a Quentin Tarantino fan. So if you are into Quentin Tarantino movies, sure, this is going to be right in your wheelhouse. But I understand why the woman next to you would be like, what was the plot? And the person who was sitting next to me had the same comment at the end, that I felt very invested in these particular characters and in the performances, but I did not feel at all invested in the story.
You just can't sit back and watch Leonardo DiCaprio try to act as like a Western bad guy
no,
and really
I,
struggle
because
he's an alcoholic.
I can, and that's the only reason that's what saves this film for me and makes it watchable for me is that aspect to it. But there, you know, so I don't think it's a perfect
film.
Did
you need a mystery? Did you need a whodunit? Did you need
love
interest?
I don't like violence,
you
so you're waiting for...
The violence doesn't come until the end.
Violence comes at the end, and that's... So it's building the anticipation.
2.5-hour movie, and it's only
2 hours and 40 minutes, and it's about 5 minutes of covering your eyes. But that 5 minutes, it's building to that, and you're just sort of waiting, knowing that it's a Quentin Tarantino film. You're waiting for that flash of violence to happen,
and
it's always going to
and
be
And I believe it's necessary
crazy. I don't
for
know,
what
because I had
doing.
My eyes closed.
It's
for
necessary.
Most of it. For you. And so I know people who are not going to see this movie strictly because they say they don't like Quentin Tarantino films. And so my thing that I am actually, and you should be happy about this, is I have been telling people that even if you're not a Quentin Tarantino movie fan, there is enough in this particular film to still really appreciate visually, aesthetically, the recreation of 1969 Hollywood, of just down to the minutia of Hollywood Boulevard as it looked in 1969, the Valley. People who are familiar with LA are really going to love seeing what has changed and what hasn't.
The production design is insane.
It is. It is. And I could appreciate that. I was just in LA last week, so it was very cool to me to see that they all went to the El Coyote restaurant on Beverly Boulevard. And I'm like, I drove right by there.
Not fictional. Happened.
Totally not fictional.
That night happened.
And exactly. And the thing is that El Coyote looks exactly this. It still looks like that. And it's still there. And the place in the Valley where they went, and the place in Hollywood, Frank and Musso's Grill in Hollywood, is still there on Hollywood Boulevard. So there are the places in the in the Hollywood Hills. We've seen all these things lately where we saw Mama Cass's home in Laurel Canyon. And so to see some of the 69 stuff kind of
she also
presented,
popped up in Rocket Man.
She's popped up in so many things now. I did love seeing all of that. And I thought aesthetically, the fact that they were very particular in their choice of the film stock
well,
that
aesthetically,
they would use.
He didn't shoot it digital. He shot it on 35mm film, mm-hmm. and he played with it. Not only do you still get the dots for the real change,
yeah.
but he scratched the film in a couple places to remind you, this is film, folks, and look, I just scratched a scene.
Yeah, and the recreation of the story within the story within the story with the acting scenes, when you get some of the biography, the filmography of Rick Dalton's character, and you see the old Bounty Law footage, and knew that was all recreated.
It's perfect. And he did an episode of Hullabaloo.
Hullabaloo. I mean, it was just great, and it reminded me some of the quirky, fun scenes, reminded me a little bit of your favorite Coen Brothers film, Hail Caesar.
It's not my favorite Coen Brothers, but it's a perfect, great Coen Brothers.
There were aspects of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood that made me immediately think, okay, this is the kind of film that Quentin Tarantino fans and Coen Brothers film fans are absolutely going to flock to and love.
They're close. Another one, you haven't seen it, but I told you about it last week because when I watched it, I watched Bad Times at El Royale.
Mm-hmm.
And in that film, Chris Hemsworth shows up as a Charles Manson figure. He's kind of playing Manson.
Ooh.
And they also play The Mamas and the Papas 1230, which features very heavily in this film as well. I'm like, wow, that's a striking coincidence.
Yeah, I mean, it's got a little of all kinds of things are thrown into the mix of this film. So there's plenty to hang your hat on, but story is just not one of them.
Well, it's not farce, but I laughed a lot.
Mm-hmm.
It's not homage. He's right. not, you know, satirizing anything. It's not nostalgia, even though we're in the past and he's glorifying. It's not nostalgia, but it's kind of a history, but an alternate history.
I think it had some nostalgia and some satire.
He's saving the 60s. The 60s ended. A lot of people believe the innocence of the 60s, the hippie culture, ended in 1969 with the murder of Sharon Tate. And I wonder if he's playing with that.
I don't know. I mean, I think you're supposed to be thinking about that murder the entire way through this film because you don't know how the reality and the fiction are going to intersect in this particular film. But then, you know, this has been the 50th anniversary. We've seen one thing after another now with the moon landing, the summer of 69. I mean, you have the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, the 50th anniversary of Woodstock. So you're seeing all these things from the summer of 69 that really are very, very celebratory in a positive way. And then you've got the reminder of this horrific crime that took place in that same time period. and the rise of Charles Manson. You're like, oh my goodness, you know, this is a cause celebrity. You don't want to necessarily indulge too much time in. But there, you know, I said you're waiting throughout this entire film for the axe to fall, and whether it's the proverbial axe or the literal axe, you just don't know what's going to happen. So that's where the drama has to draw from, because there are no dramatic spikes or dramatic arcs to carry you through otherwise.
We just have a big disconnect on our reception of this film.
Yes.
I love that it meanders. There's no reason for the Bruce Lee scene. I think it establishes Cliff's character a little bit, as he's just such an honest guy to a fault that actually hurts him professionally. There's a Bruce Lee scene in here where he's kind of mocking. Tarantino's mocking Bruce Lee a little bit in his mouth and what he's saying, and Cliff kind of calls him on it. It's a wonderful scene. Kurt Russell's involved in it. And what that does, it helps make, for me, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood the best movie of 2019 so far.
And for me, the meandering is what detracts for me. So that's the difference. But that's going to be the difference of the people who call it a masterpiece and the people like me who are just going to say they really liked it but did not love it. And so I think you're actually going to see both of those camps for this particular film. And I do think you will still see a significant number of people who are turned off, who don't go strictly because they see that it's a Tarantino film. And then you've got the folks like me who are somewhere in the middle that are like, oh, I'm going to see it even though it's a Quentin Tarantino film, because Leo DiCaprio and Brad Pitt are absolutely worth watching for 2 hours and 40 minutes. But you know, then you've got the Charlies of the world who are just going to embrace everything that Quentin Tarantino wants you to embrace. And it's for you.
Because I recognize him as a superior, elite filmmaker, because he always surprises me with something new, even though there's a lot of reminders of what he's already done. There's just reminders of Inglourious Bastards in here, you know, setting Nazis on fire. Yeah. He's actually he actually sets Nazis on fire again in this film.
Yeah, he manages to get a lot of things in, and I do think it's worth noting that even if you're not a Tarantino fan, this is actually a movie that you're going to still find some things to really enjoy and appreciate.
Well, everyone's going to have to watch it, because it's going to get nominated for a boatload of Oscars.
Certainly for cinematography.
Leo will get nominated. Cinematography, screenplay, and possibly picture.
Pitt
maybe for supporting actor. I know he's a co-lead, but they're going to bill him as supporting. And Margot Robbie might even be a sneaky competitor.
Maybe, but I don't think she's got a big enough role to really survive.
There are three locks: Leo, cinematography, and screenplay. Maybe editing. But.
Well, I'll tell you the one name that I had to write down to make sure that I don't forget come the time we do our WAFCA awards is for the young actor. You know, like the youth performance.
Oh, the girl?
The little girl, Julia Butters. So this child actor.
It's so Tarantino, by the way.
Julia Butters is so freaking good in her 2 or 3 minutes on screen.
I forgot about that.
She holds her own in scenes with Leo DiCaprio.
But she wipes the floor with DiCaprio.
She totally wipes the floor with DiCaprio.
And, I mean, he sets it up that way. He has to.
And I looked up. She's like 12 years old now. So she totally fits into that category that I'm just like, I've got to make sure that I keep her name on the list, because right now that's my key front runner. And is she for me is the lock.
Do you see the irony? Her scene is superfluous. She's a meander. She is the opposite of plot.
She is, but man, she is good. And so she makes the most of it. And so I'm just saying, Julia Butters is one to watch in the future.
Because, that little girl put Leo in his place.
She is like a method actor who works up against him in one of his TV scenes. And it is just, she's precious. So.
Did you know, by the way, the director of that Western, the old guy saying, I don't want Rick Dalton, I need an actor. You know who that is?
Who?
Friedrich, the eldest male child in The Sound of Music.
The Sound of Music, wow.
That's him.
Yeah, no, I mean, this film has a lot of people. There's a lot going on in this
movie. And there will be more. Like, I bet we've barely scratched the surface.
I'm sure.
On things he did in here that we didn't even notice yet.
Oh, well, and that reminds me, too, that you need to stay through the credits.
There's a thing. Yeah. You know, it's Red one Apple thing. Cigarettes is a thing. Yes. That's from Pulp Fiction.
So once you figure out that, you know, it's one thing with all the Marvel movies where you know you need to stay and you know exactly what kind of scene you're going to get at the end. This one is just a fun, it's just like a fun little bonus. At the end of the film, somewhere mid credits, so it's definitely worth. You just got to know to stick around for that because it's worth it. And again, Leo DiCaprio, awesome. So I do hope he's still in the mix for lead actor. So again, you know, masterpiece not so much to me, but really fun, interesting, worth talking about kind of film. Absolutely.
Yeah, you might as well see it out there just because everyone's talking about it.
On film, so if you can see it. If you can see it in what we saw it in a theater, they're very particular about making sure that press saw it in a theater with the right projection equipment available to show it as it's meant to be seen. And so if you do see a difference in where it's playing and in what format, you really want that, 35 millimeter?
Oh, yeah, I would not want to see this at my local automated digital multiplex.
No.
All right, our next film is a documentary, and you can watch it right now. It's on Netflix. It opened on Wednesday on Netflix. You saw it at AFI Docs. I just popped it on Netflix the other day. And it's called The Great Hack, and it's meant to scare you. If you recall...
And it does.
After the 2016 election, and people were wondering why, who, and how, and to what extent, a particular company came to light, Cambridge Analytica. For people who follow the daily scandal closely, Cambridge Analytica is something you already know. For other people who just bop in and out, it's, okay, I'd heard of Cambridge Analytica. I know they had worked for the Trump campaign, and they bought a bunch of Facebook ads. This delves into who they are, who the staff is, and how they did it, and what happened to them. And it really is meant to scare you and what you're doing willy-nilly with your digital footprint. Every time you hit the like button, every time you go to a website, every time you take a quiz, you're marking yourself. And apparently you have 50,000 to 70,000 individual data points on you. So this professor that they're following in the film, David Carroll, he sued. He sued Cambridge Analytica. He says, okay, I want to see my data points. You show me what you have on me. And that's the central, you know, the documentary goes many places. Mm-hmm. That's the central line of him kind of suing Cambridge Analytica. It scared me, Hannah. I'm tighter than some people on my digital footprint, but I still don't. I'm not as careful as maybe I should be. But apparently nobody's careful, and it doesn't even matter how careful you are.
It doesn't.
They've got you.
And I think that it's a cautionary tale that nobody's really learned from because not enough people have seen the inside workings of all of this yet. But like when that whole face app thing erupted last week, I didn't care what I would look like at 92. I wasn't dumb enough to download that app. I was like, this is exactly the kind of thing that The Great Hack is sort of warning you about, that if you download an app to use it like that, you pretty much are giving away. You are saying that you have the right now to the picture that I'm using now belongs to someone else. And so I got that. And so I'm a little more careful, I think, now than I might have been a year ago. It really just showed how this data, your personal data, is mined in such a way that it's weaponized and used for political and cultural warfare. And you talk about meandering. This movie then meanders really from the story of the professor suing for his information to this woman, Brittany, I think, who used to work for Cambridge Analytica, who then puts herself on a bit of a pedestal and becomes some whistleblower. So here she... You know, she participates in all that data mining and exploitation of your data. And then suddenly, you know, is made to look like she's grown a conscience and becomes this whistleblower against Cambridge Analytica. And she actually appeared. She was at the Q&A following the screening at AFI Docs of this film. And so I wasn't buying into the heroism part of how she was being played, because she still really did, you know, she made the most of her time at Cambridge Analytica, and I feel like, you know, you needed to put the brakes on a little earlier. I think it ended with her like being really called to testify in front of to talk to Robert Mueller's team. So there was a lot that's very timely in watching this documentary. I think it it is. It's designed to scare the crap out of you, and if you watch it, you will probably, at least for a few hours or days, be a little more careful about your you know, social footprint.
I found Brittany Kaiser to be a very complicated character. Mm-hmm. She was painted into a corner and almost forced to become a whistleblower, because if she didn't, she would have been nailed to the wall. Like her boss was Alexander Nix, who co-founded Cambridge Analytica alongside Steve Bannon. So that's kind of the flavor of the company, if you just say it was co-founded by Steve Bannon. But Brittany had she said something very interesting that I did not notice. She says, data surpassed oil in value. It is the most valuable commodity on earth. Your data. You send your data out and it comes back to you as targeted messaging, as propaganda, to change your behavior, to push you somewhere maybe you didn't think you were going to go.
And the thing is, it's not – one of the things I've really learned over the past year with the work that I've been doing too with them and dabbling a little bit in marketing is that this is happening every organization is mining data. They are all about analytics and retargeting – second target, third target, and you know who does this, who opens this thing versus that thing, and then they retarget you, thinking that, well, let's see now that they did this if they'll do that, and so every business is doing it. Every organization, Google is constantly trying to reevaluate how they're taking the data and their algorithms. So it's part of society now. It's part of business. And so it's going to be very interesting to just see where it all goes. But it really is just a way to show you that this is happening. This is how it happens. This is how the 2016 election was likely influenced. This is how Brexit vote was likely influenced. And you just go, oh my God, you know, you take that out of the mix and really what might have been different. So cautionary tale indeed.
Yeah, it's saying because of this, we may no longer have something as what we consider to be free and fair elections. There's now kind of thumbs on the scales. Another thread in the film is there's an investigative reporter for The Guardian. And in the end, she's giving a TED talk and she's calling out names. She's saying, Mark Zuckerberg, Sheryl Sandberg, Larry Page, you all claim you had this dream of a connected world. But what you did was tear the world apart into different sections and sects.
And it's showing that there were trade-offs along the way. And so the more that they realized they could get this information, the more they then ran with it and learned what they could do with it. And it's an absolute trade-off with everything that we do now that, you know, you've got to figure out that balance of what, you know, what's private and what you really feel like you need to keep private versus what you can actually gain sometimes by giving up a little bit of the privacy. And there are gains too. So it's a really slippery slope, but it just made it, it makes the documentary itself was not that great to me, but the themes and the what it's explaining was definitely informative. And so I'm glad I saw it, but you know, it was not like a great documentary as far as I
No, thank concerned. You for the transition. Regarding the filmmaking, there are times, and maybe about half the film, where it's got a Dateline 60 Minutes vibe. Mm-hmm. And then this happened, and then I confronted him and see what he had to say. It's co-directed. We know these directors. Jehane Nughaim and Karim Amer, they were nominated for a Best Documentary Oscar for the 2013 film The Square, which is about Tahrir Square in Cairo when that was going down in the Arab Spring, and they were executive producers on a wonderful animated film. It was in my top five animated films that year, called The Breadwinner. We discussed it on this podcast.
Oh, yeah.
The executive producer.
I didn't know
that
they were involved. Okay.
So she comes with serious bona fides on a documentary film, but it feels like a longer news report at times.
It did. You talk about meandering, and it kind of felt like sometimes they weren't sure their characters changed and their central characters changed as they uncovered certain amounts of information. It's kind of like, remember with Icarus, where we're like, you know, they should have just made a slightly different documentary once they had this material and realized what the best story in there was.
Well, their main character didn't come in until about a third of the way through, Brittany Kaiser. And then they put a lot of eggs in the Kaiser basket.
They did.
And she is very untrustworthy. She's an unreliable narrator. I don't trust her. She's out for yours truly.
Yeah, I felt that way, and I'm not so sure that that they found the right balance for all these different elements and characters. So I value it more just for the, again, the cautionary tale that it presents, and just making sure that people are just a little more aware of how Cambridge Analytica came to be and what they actually did, because I certainly didn't understand it all that much before the movie.
Well, in our last episode, I plugged that I was forcing my wife to go through an 80s film history class. You know, we had done Stand By Me, Top Gun, and when we left off, I was going to do Flashdance, and I went and I rented Flashdance because nobody actually owns Flashdance.
Because I told you you should see Flashdance.
And the disc didn't work, so we still haven't seen Flashdance. So what I did was we watched The Goonies, and she really, really liked The Goonies. She thought Mama Fratelli was a man. She didn't understand. She's like, how can that be a woman? I was like, no, it's a woman. And she doesn't know, you know, really understand what it means to see such a young Sean Astin or such a young Josh Brolin, his first son, by the way. But she just thought it was good. And I didn't, looking at it, how, you know, 30 some years later for me, I didn't realize Chunk is really the star of the film. The sound editing is terrible. They're always screaming on top of each other, and at multiple points, it's really hard to listen to.
Well, you know, but production values have changed.
Yeah, and the editing is pretty
years.
Bad, but yeah, it was good to revisit a childhood film like The Goonies.
Well, and I wanted to revisit one thing that I think I just mentioned briefly the last time we were chatting was The Farewell is another film that is actually it presents that really decent dramedy alternative for people that want that sort of smaller film. It feels a little more like a foreign film with Awkwafina. It's getting a lot of really good word of mouth because it really has created an opportunity to have discussions about end-of-life issues in a rather relaxed sort of way. And it really is just about how this Chinese family decides to hide the truth from grandma that she's got terminal lung cancer. And Awkwafina plays this sort of millennial Chinese-American writer who just can't believe that you'd hide something like that. But it's she and her family go back to China under the guise of a wedding happening in the family so that they can all spend time with grandma. And she's forced to keep this secret because that's just what you do. And it's relatable across cultures and across generations. It's partially in Chinese and partially in English. But just one of those smaller films out there that actually is quite bittersweet and getting good buzz.
The Farewell has 100% on the tomato meter.
It's one of those ones.
It's very hard to do.
Because you just kind of come out of it and it's really hard to not like it on some level because you can relate. Everybody can relate to how everyone reacts differently to the prospect of dying or to the prospect of loved ones dying. And you know, when you joke and, you know, it's sort of like morbid humor comes into play. And so it just is one of those ones. And Awkwafina is really good. And so here, you know, most people only have remembered her from her breakout supporting roles in Crazy Rich Asians and Ocean's 8. But this one, she shows that she's actually got a really good knack for balancing the drama and the comedy, which can be really difficult to do.
All right. Well, a quick recap of the show. Quentin Tarantino is back with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I know it is so far 2019's best film.
I believe that there are aspects of it that will be awards worthy. For me, I don't know whether it would be in my top 5 or 10 for best film of the year by the time the end of the year rolls around. Certainly there are some pieces of it that are good. Leo DiCaprio, awesome. Brad Pitt, very good. Fun aspects to the film. There are elements that are great, But I think some people might want to go see something like The Farewell instead.
The Great Hack is on Netflix right now. What it is just another piece of the puzzle of the 2016 election. If you're into technology, if you're into social media, it's up your alley. If you're saturated and you're tired of all this stuff, well, you probably were never going to watch it anyway.
That's true. And it's not a must watch. It's more like just take our word for it that that data mining is scary.
Once again, I'm looking for your recommendations. If you know what Kate needs to watch next, shoot us a line, shoot us a tweet.
I'm just going to keep saying Flashdance
until I get a workable copy.
I'm sure all you've got to do is just download the music video from Maniac, and that's really all you need to know. There's a lobster scene, I believe, that's also very critical that you could probably find on YouTube.
I'll show her Annie Hall for that.
So just get the lobster scene and the Maniac video, and you're good.
Well, on behalf of the Cinema Clash, thank you very much for listening to this episode. I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah is presented twice each weekend on RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on RadioSt.Pete.com.